at Allaire.com.
This is The Connection. I'm John McChesney. We're born, we grow up, we grow old. In the inevitable cycle of life, the modern-day language of retirement tells us that the last phase should be the best. A time for the dream house on the beach, the dream vacation. But the number of Americans remaining in the workforce past the ripe old age of 65 has hit a 20-year high, and the data roller coaster is still rumbling uphill. It's not just that we're living longer. There are fewer financial incentives to drop out of the rat race and let the old 401k do the job. And Americans are afraid, terrified, that Social Security will dissolve and leave them at the mercy of uncertain company pension plans and dwindling health benefits. But it's not just economics. Culture is at work, too. The need for a constant pastime. Love of work can trump the lure of leisure. Many Americans aren't embalmed in their office chairs. Rather, each morning, they're revived. Connection listeners, what are the forces driving your retirement plans? The number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or join us online at theconnection.org. I'm joined today in the studio by Boston College's Joe Quinn. Joe Quinn is an economist. He's the dean of BC's College of Arts and Sciences, and he's a retirement specialist. Welcome to The Connection, Joe.
Thank you very much.
And I'm joined on the line from California by Mark Friedman. He's the founder of Civic Ventures and the author of Prime Time, How Baby Boomers Will Revolutionize Retirement and Transform America. Welcome to The Connection, Mark.
Good morning, John.
Joe, up until now, I mean, these numbers we're hearing recently are sort of surprising, because up until now, Americans have been retiring at younger and younger ages, haven't they? I mean, it used to be, if you worked on the farm, you worked until you dropped or you couldn't move.
Absolutely correct. We have data going back into the end of the 19th century showing that for really a decade, older American men have been retiring earlier and earlier and earlier. And this trend accelerated dramatically after World War II. If you look back in 1950, for example, 50% of American men aged 70 were still in the labor force. 20 years later, that 50% had dropped to 30%, and today, I shouldn't say today, in mid-1980s, in 1985, it was about 15%. So from 50 to 15%. If you look at men aged 65, 72% of them were working in 1950. By 1985, that was 30%. And even men aged 62, who 80% of whom were in the labor force in 1950 and 1960, by 1985, that 80% had dropped to 50%.
So I presume all of this drop over those years was a result of a labor movement and getting better and better retirement packages and forcing the retirement.
Yeah. Well, mandatory retirement was certainly very important in those days and, of course, isn't now. That's one of the stories we want to talk about. But I think primarily what was going on here is America was becoming wealthier and wealthier over this century, and one of the ways in which we chose to spend that wealth was in more leisure late in life. We also spent more time in college, entered the labor force later, worked fewer hours per year while we worked. But early retirement was a big part of how we spent, in essence, that additional wealth.
So we're seeing that turnaround now. How do we know Americans are retiring later in life?
Well, here's what's remarkable. Again, that century-long story is a big story, earlier and early retirement of older American men. But an equally dramatic story is what's happened over the last 15 years, since 1985. And that is that this trend towards earlier and early retirement has slammed to a halt. To exaggerate a bit, a long-term downward trend has turned flat, and American men are no longer retiring earlier and earlier. If you look closely at the last several years of data, in fact, these labor force participation rates are actually increasing for older men.
And so what about women? Are they?
Well, women, the story is very different and the same. It's very different in that in the post-war period, two phenomena were underway. One, folks were retiring earlier. And second, women, particularly married women, were entering the labor force in bigger and bigger numbers. So these two phenomena sort of canceled each other out. And in the post-war period, up till the mid-80s, the trends for women were very flat, very gentle increases, very gentle declines, depending on which category of older women you looked at. But what's the same is that at the very same time, in the middle of the 1980s, there was a dramatic break from trend, and these flat lines that existed for 35 years moved dramatically upward. So for both older men and women today, many more are in the labor force and working today than those older trends would have predicted.
And is that because people are finding it financially impossible, or because we are in love with our work and we're healthier and living longer and we just don't want to retire?
Well, as is almost always true with the elderly or any big demographic group, there's some truth in all these answers. The really interesting question about this phenomenon is not whether or not it's existing. It obviously exists. The data show that. The interesting question is why. And there are two types of stories which have very different implications about the future. One story is that this is a cyclical phenomenon. It's the business cycle. And the strong economy, and the economy has been very strong since the mid-80s, with the exception of a recession in the early 90s, but the strong economy has increased the demand for labor, including older workers, and that's what's going on. The second story, the one I've emphasized more, emphasizes more permanent changes in the retirement environment, changes that aren't cyclical, changes that aren't going away, even if the economy fades. For example, we've already mentioned mandatory retirement, which used to cover about half of American workers, is now gone. It's illegal for the vast majority of American workers.
It's illegal.
It is. There's a couple of groups for whom mandatory retirement is still possible, but for the vast majority of workers, it is illegal to have a mandatory retirement program, even in my business, even in the university.
What made it illegal, very quickly?
Well, the change in the law. It was basically viewed as sort of a civil rights issue, that there's no reason to have these laws that are age-specific like that. So
good.
It's gone.
I'm glad to hear that.
Yes. But also, there's other important changes. Social Security and retirement incentives have changed in important ways. Social Security no longer penalizes work after age 60. As it used to, and I'd be happy to talk about that in a little more detail.
Actually rewards it, doesn't it?
Depends on how long you plan on living, but the main change is it used to be a severe disincentive to continued work, no longer the case. Analogous things are happening in the employer sector. With employer pensions, the nature of jobs are changing, more emphasis on service jobs, less on manufacturing, and people are living longer and healthier lives.
1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. We're talking about retirement. We'd like to know what your plans are out there in Connection Land. And we want to go now to Mark Friedman. Mark, you've written extensively on retirement, and your organization provides older people with new kinds of work experiences in their communities. Are you seeing this same trend of people working longer now?
Absolutely, and I want to echo what Joe Quinn was saying. I think what we're seeing is a much deeper, longer-term, permanent structural change that is reflected in the workplace, but it's also reflected in other sectors of society. I think we'll see it in civic work and all kinds of vehicles for older adults to continue to be part of the action, to contribute, to be vital. To retrace some of the history from a complementary perspective to what Joe Quinn was talking about, we're also watching the lengthening of American lives, 30 years over the last century, and in particular, people getting healthier. The Los Angeles Times did a survey a couple months ago which showed that people felt 19 years younger than their chronological age. And I think what's happening is people are entering later life. The old notion of focusing on leisure is something that just doesn't seem sustainable for 25 or 30 years. A recurring phrase I heard as I went around the country interviewing people is, who can play golf for 30 years? And I think that dovetails as well with new research about the importance of continuing to contribute, to have strong social ties in later life as a way of preserving physical and mental health. And then I think that there's a third layer as well, which just has to do with the question of meaning. I think there's an enormous longing for people in later life to live lives that still matter. They don't want to go off and jog in place on the sidelines. They want to continue being an active contributing part of their community. And so I think we'll see an increase in the coming decades, not only in labor force participation, but involvement in civil society and a dramatic change, I think, in people's expectations for later life. You mentioned in your introduction that this phase of life could become the best phase of all, and I think there's a great possibility for many Americans that they'll finally get the balance right. They'll get the balance between work, social contribution, meaning, family life, right and be able to do it for a sustained period of time.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. We're talking about retirement. We'd like to hear about your retirement plans. Mark, one of the things that strikes me about this is for a long time, you mentioned golf, and I go frequently to these high-tech conferences down in Palm Springs where there must be 80 golf courses sprouting out of the desert, and it seems like the American ideal of retirement is to have one of these condos that backs up on the golf course and every day go out and do 18 holes. You seem to be saying that's changing dramatically. It's possible now, isn't it, to really reinvent yourself at retirement?
Absolutely. F. Scott Fitzgerald said that in the 1920s, there are no second acts in American lives, and that's patently false today and getting ever falser. There's second acts, third acts, fourth acts. But I want to go back to your golf story, because I think one of the changes that happened historically is that after World War II, as mass retirement became increasingly prevalent, people were continuing to be healthy, living longer. Later life essentially became a state of limbo. One of the leading sociologists of aging, 1950s, described it as a roleless role. And Walter Reuther talked about retirement as being too old to work, too young to die. And this created a very awkward phase in American life. To the rescue came first the pension industry, eager to get people to think more optimistically about later life and to sell more pension policies. But then, most prominently, the retirement community developers, Del Webb in particular in the early 1960s, came in and started selling us this idea that retirement wasn't a state of limbo, wasn't a roleless role. It was actually nothing. It was an aristocratic life. It was, for the first time ever, the average American could be an aristocrat. And Webb was the guy who put golf into retirement. When he developed Sun City, he built these Levittown-type houses in the middle of the desert and surrounded them with a golf course. He's the guy who invented the phrase the golden years, and probably more than anybody else helped to elevate that cultural idea of leisure as the great triumph of later life. But now we're seeing that break down. Again, who can play golf for 30 years? People have much higher expectations for this stage of life.
Joe Quinn, there must be a difference here between people who have to go every day and screw the same screw on an automobile in an assembly line and someone who has a satisfying professional life and wants to continue it. I mean, if the idea of staying on the job on the assembly line may not be that much fun. What do we see in terms of class differences in retirement patterns?
Well, you're seeing some very interesting changes over time. As Mark has pointed out, this idea of retirement as a stage of full-time leisure is something that is not a goal of a lot of people. Not only are there changes on when people are retired, but there's also dramatic changes in how people retire. The stereotypical retirement has somebody working on a full-time job up to a particular date, stopping work that day, never working again, claiming Social Security and retirement benefits, no doubt about when that person retired. But many people nowadays, as Mark implies, are using what we call bridge jobs, which are jobs that are between full-time career work and complete labor force withdrawal. For many people, retirement is a process, not a particular event.
So, Joe, we're going to come back to that when we rejoin. You're listening to The Connection from WBUR Boston and National Public Radio. I'm John McChesney. We're talking about retirement. You can call us at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK.
When you're old and ugly in the way.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Brick.
Let's find love while we may, because I know I'll hate you when you are old and gray. So say you love me here and now, I'll make the most of that. Say you love and trust me, for I know you'll disgust me when you're old and getting fat.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. You can join us on The Connection. We're talking about retirement. My guests are Joe Quinn. He's an economics professor and dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at Boston College and a specialist in retirement. And Mark Friedman. He's the founder of the nonprofit group Civic Ventures, which organizes work and volunteer programs for older people. Joe, we were talking just before the break about class differences in retirement patterns and kinds of work. I remember when I was in the military, for example, people would stay in with the idea that in 20 years they could get out with like two-thirds of their military salary and quit early.
Absolutely. Well, these bridge jobs that I mentioned before the break, these transitional jobs between full-time career work and complete labor force withdrawal, tend to be more important at both ends of the socioeconomic scale than they are in the middle, which suggests that there are two very different phenomena going on. At the lower end, people with low lifetime pay, probably low Social Security, maybe no pension, maybe don't own a home, these people keep working because they have to keep working. They need the income, they need the health benefits, and that's why they remain in the labor force.
So that's at the very, very lower end.
But at the upper end, we also find that bridge jobs are very important. These are people, in many cases, who could afford to retire, who have the private pensions and Social Security and savings to retire, but who choose to stay on in the labor force. Again, not necessarily full-time, not necessarily on their career job, but jobs for them provide a lot more than a paycheck. As Mark pointed out, jobs provide a reason to get up in the morning, a feeling of contribution to society, and they're very important to people over and above the money they provide.
But in the middle, and how big is that middle?
Well, it's traditional retirement. A one-shot event is still probably the modal event. It's probably more important than these bridge jobs. My statistics suggest that between a third and a half of older American workers utilize bridge jobs on the way out. So both things are important, as is always the case with the elderly, a wide variety of experiences. And it's important to keep that in mind.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Susan is on the line. Susan, welcome to The Connection.
Hello.
Hi, Susan.
Hi. A lot of what you've been talking about is kind of really positive for people living longer and enjoying a productive life. But I want to suggest another scenario that's going on here, and I'll use my parents as an example. They both retired in their mid to late 60s. My father owned a business. They weren't wealthy. They weren't poor. You know, they looked forward to Social Security and their retirement. They owned their house. They had a savings. But my mother went back to work in her late 60s, and my father recently went back to work. He's 79 years old, to help defray the cost of my mother's medicine. You know, they did all the things they were supposed to do. Of course, they have Medicare. Of course, they have supplementary medical insurance. But it doesn't cover medicine, and my mother's medicine costs, she's on like 10 prescriptions, has forced my father to go back to work
at 79.
For minimum salary.
So, Susan, what you're saying sounds like it squares with what we were saying at the open of the show, that economic necessity is forcing people to work longer. Joe Quinn, does that sound...
I believe it. It's certainly true for current retirees, some of whom come back into the labor force. And it's also reflected in surveys of people who are still working, of baby boomers. A recent survey by the American Association for Retired People, 80% of baby boomers suggested that they expect to keep working at least part-time past age 65, about a third of them for the enjoyment it brings, and about a quarter of them because they need the income.
Yes.
So that in a later survey, 1998, from another group, 61% of workers said they expect to work for pay after retirement. Again, many for retirement reasons, for financial reasons, and many other to improve the quality of their life, which is, again, the other story.
Susan, I just wanted to ask you quickly, is clearly not what your father expected, I take it. Has he found a job that is satisfying to him, or is he doing something he really would rather not be doing?
He's doing something he would rather not be doing. And it brings up another issue for me, well, and I think for the country. I mean, I hate to say this, but I'm 50. my husband and I have retirements, we have 401ks and everything else, but, you know, this issue, I think, focuses around medical care. People can have their retirement, they can have their Social Security, they can own their house, but the incredible cost of medicine, this, I don't believe the country is dealing with in a productive way. And many, many people, one of the things I lose when I retire is my medical coverage.
1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Susan, thanks for your call. Anne Marie is calling from Pocatello, Idaho.
Hello. I'm a baby boomer, and my husband and I are retiring next year. He'll be 48.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a decision we made the day we got married. We took all our wedding gifts and returned them for cash and invested it, and every decision from that day on forward has been with this in mind. And although I certainly empathize with Susan's parents and the situation they're in, I think a lot of baby boomers are very used to instant gratification and find it difficult to discipline themselves to the point where they can retire early. But we've done that, and it's worked.
Mark Friedman, you've written a book about the effect that you anticipate baby boomers will have on retirement in America. Does this experience square with what you're thinking about it?
Well, listening to Susan and Anne Marie, I think there are many people who are in the middle of the two stories we've heard, which folks who are going to need to work and need some kind of income, but will have an extra measure of freedom. They won't need to work for the same kind of money they needed in midlife when they were putting their kids through school, and there won't be the same burden of ambitions as there were in midlife. And people can focus more acutely on finding a new labor of love. I think actually of my own father's experience. He started out as a teacher, somebody who always wanted to teach, but for economic reasons became a school administrator. And now in retirement, in part to pay for his medical costs, he's gone back to teaching. And two nights a week he teaches phys ed to developmentally disabled adults. And he's kind of recaptured this joy from earlier in life. It's become a great passion for him. You know, it reminds me of the point that you were making earlier when you were talking about the military. I think we're seeing a lot of folks who are finishing a first career in their late 40s or early 50s, like so many people who are career military folks, and then moving into careers like teaching, which they might not have been able to do without the benefit of the military pension, but is an area where there's desperate human resource need in the society. We're going to need 200,000 new teachers in the next decade. In fact, there's a federal program now called Troops to Teachers, which helps military personnel make the transition into public school teaching in urban schools. And I think we're going to see a tremendous move into these kind of public interest careers, which will provide an income, but won't necessarily have the same the people doing that work won't necessarily have the same economic needs that they did earlier.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. We're talking about retirement on The Connection, and I want to bring in a favorite of mine, a person who works for National Public Radio, Dan Shore.
Dan,
once Robert Siegel told me, he said, the last thing Dan Shore will do in this life will be to file a commentary. Siegel is a great admirer of yours, as well as myself.
It works the other way, too.
How old are you, Dan?
I will be 85 in August.
And do you have any retirement plans?
No, I have a lot of plans to not retire. My memoirs, this is the first time this has been mentioned on the air, have just been completed and will come out in May, so that readers in Boston should really start saving up their nickels to read Staying Tuned, with my memoirs of the past many, many years. And I listen to other people call in, and I can also sympathize with those who have to go back to work or have to stay at work for economic reasons. In my case, that is not true. What is true is that work to me, especially at NPR, especially writing a book, is more like a hobby than real work. I would be hard put to it if I had to retire to know what I would do with myself.
I feel the same way. I've been looking down that barrel and feeling like I don't want to stop working in radio. It's just too exciting. 1-800.
Can I just add one
sure,
point
Dan.
To that?
Sure.
I think it's a point that you are suggesting which should be underlined. One of the reasons that people like you, and you're a lot younger than I am, but still, one of the reasons that people like us can go on working past the age that used to be the retirement age is, first of all, the fact that we're kept healthy for longer periods, but more than that, that the nature of work has changed a lot. There's much less physical work and much more work done with your computer, with your typewriter, and with your head. And therefore, it is easier today. If I had to become a coal miner today or go into a steel mill, that wouldn't be feasible at my age. But it is feasible for me to think, or at least as well as I've ever thought.
1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. We're talking about retirement. We have Dan Shore on the line. Stay with us, Dan. Jack is calling from Williamsburg, Virginia. Jack, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. I'm in a tunnel. I hope I don't lose you.
Okay, we hope not, too.
What's your question,
Jack?
Just a comment. I'm within 2 years of military retirement. Kind of sneaks up on you. I'll be 55. Tired after 30 years of picking up 24 hours a day and going where you're told. Military retirement's not going to be enough to live on. But I don't want to do anything that is going to continue to cause burnout. I'm looking at maybe something as simple as going to someplace like Colonial Williamsburg, enjoying doing what you're doing, not making a whole lot of money, but augmenting the income.
So you have any specific jobs in mind?
Geez, I don't know. Maybe Thomas Jefferson.
Tell me what you
mean. I mean, a reenactor. Something in the historical. You know, it's not going to be brain teasing. I've been teasing my brain for 35 years. So.
Well, let me clarify what Jack is telling you about.
It's Dan Shore.
Since I've been at Colonial Williamsburg, they do reenactments of colonial times and colonial periods with people in costumes. What I think we're hearing here is a volunteer to play Thomas Jefferson in some kind of skit at Colonial Williamsburg. Is that right?
For $7.50 an hour, I'll do it.
Okay.
Yeah, this is Mark Friedman. Just to, I think there's so many folks like Jack who are interested in keep going and doing work that's of importance and also brings meaning. But as a society, we're not very good at helping folks make this transition into this next stage. We've got a whole college and university system to help folks go from youth into midlife. But so many people are essentially on their own as they're trying to navigate their way into this increasingly long phase of life. And I think we're going to need to invent a new kind of institution, a transitional institution. We've been thinking about something called a Life Option Center, where people could go to think about this third stage of life and how it could be characterized by learning, growth, contribution, and to get connected to those opportunities that are out there, and also to training and retooling so that they can take on new passions in this stage of life.
Jack, thanks very much for your call. Dan, I'm curious about, I know what you're doing at 85, but what about your friends? What about your colleagues of the past in the news business? Many of them doing
well. I'll tell you, the NPR press release about me starts by saying that I am the last member of Ed Morrow's CBS news team who is still alive and active in daily journalism. And that will give you some idea. I mean, if you live to 85, you have the not very happy experience of having colleagues and friends and so on disappear while you go on.
Dan, thanks very much for being with us on The Connection.
My pleasure.
Joe Quinn and Mark, I'll throw this at both of you. One of the things I'm curious about is what we know about retirement patterns in other countries, in the sense of I was reading last week. We had Adam Gopnik in here, and he was talking about Paris. And I noticed that Paris truck drivers were on strike for reducing the mandatory retirement age to 55. And a number of people in France were following suit there. Mark, what do you know about European retirement habits?
Well, Joe probably knows the statistics better than me, but they. Europeans have retired even earlier than Americans for many decades, and they have greater life expectancy. So this phase of life between leaving the full-time workforce and being disabled or passing away is quite considerable. It's probably the principal reason for the phenomenal gardens in the United Kingdom. But I'm actually heading off to the UK in a week, where a program that we've developed in the United States, and which is in a number of the connection cities, Boston, Philadelphia, San Francisco, called the Experience Corps, is about to be launched by Tony Blair, in his words, to create a gray army of volunteers to help improve public education and healthcare in the United Kingdom. And it's an initiative he's planning to put over $200 million into, to try to reactivate the older population and to make better use for the society of the human resources in that group.
A gray army of volunteers. Joe Quinn, just very quickly, you said we're coming up on a break. What other numbers do we know about?
Well, Europe provides some great case studies, because many countries in Europe are several decades ahead of us on the aging curve. The proportion 65 and over, for example, now is what ours will be in 20 years. Mark is right. Europeans tend to have much lower labor force participation rates late in life, and they also do much less of this bridge job activity. There's much less work in retirement. They tend to have more generous retirement benefits than the United States, which may be one reason why more people retire in the old traditional fashion. But they have long life expectancies, in some countries longer than ours, and I think these issues are very, very much on the political plate over there.
If we have all this money in this country, I mean, we've had a pretty fine economy over the past 10 years. How come we're working so hard? Is it just European attitudes toward work, that the French and the Italians really don't look at us as a model to follow?
Well, I think some of it is attitudinal. Many Americans love their jobs. And again, I don't want to say that people are staying on full-time on their career jobs forever, but many Americans are deciding, with these long and sort of productive decades ahead of them at traditional retirement age, that some mix of leisure and work is preferable to continued full-time work or complete labor force withdrawal. It's the mix, I think, that's the important point here.
Mark, very quickly, are we seeing a lot more Americans going back to school at retirement age to retool, to do something else? You mentioned that earlier, and I wasn't listening to everything you said, but are we seeing that? We have a very short period of time for you to answer that question.
Absolutely. 20 years ago, when Elder Hostel was started, the founders of that group were treated as if they were absolutely insane. The idea of going back to school in later life was something exotic. Now we have 300,000 people going to programs like Elder Hostel, but also a vast increase in people going to four-year and two-year institutions.
Let's come back to that after the break. You're listening to The Connection from WBUR in Boston and National Public Radio. I'm John McChesney. We're talking about retirement.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Sophos at Allaire.com.
Up in the morning, out on the job, I work like the devil for my pay. I know that a lucky old son has nothing to do to roll around heaven all day.
I'm John McChesney. You're listening to The Connection. We're talking about retirement. My guests are Joe Quinn, a specialist in retirement from Boston College, and Mark Friedman, who's the founder of a nonprofit group called Civic Ventures, which gives people something useful to do after they've retired. And Mark, just before we broke, we were talking about people going back to school to retool themselves, and we didn't quite get finished with that. So let's start there again.
Well, you talked earlier about people wanting to reinvent their lives, and I think that that's an increasingly widespread desire. And I think people are going to go back to school not just for their own self-development, but to prepare for new kinds of engagement. In prime time, I wrote about a man by the name of Marv Welt in Portland, Oregon, who was a management consultant but had a great love for fishing and wanted to help kids. And so he went back to Portland State and took courses in marine biology and environmental issues and started an environmental education program focused on water pollution in the Portland public schools. And so education provided this bridge for him to pursue a deeply felt passion. And I think we're gonna see people use the education system at this what used to be the retirement juncture to help prepare for these new kinds of involvement. But I want to make another point, too, which relates to Elder Hostel, which I talked about, which is an absolutely wonderful organization. And it's really helped change how we think about education in later life, from an exotic pursuit 20 years ago to something that people actually look forward to. I think a lot of people retire so that they can take courses like Elder Hostel courses. And I think what we're going to see is an increase in a lot of new kinds of ideas and arrangements like Elder Hostel in the society over the next 20 years as people have a desire to continue to be involved. And I'm seeing around the country a wave of social entrepreneurialism, of people who are entering this third stage of life, not liking the options out there and taking matters into their own hands, creating entirely new arrangements. People like Marv Welt creating his environmental education program. One of my favorites is a clinic movement that's around the country now. There are over 100 of retired doctors who are volunteering for free to provide no-cost health care to people who have no other access to care. And my favorite is in San Mateo, California, the Samaritan House Clinic, where over 40 doctors and nurses come in every day and provide high-quality care to folks in the community. And they're really kind of getting back to why they went into medicine in the first place, which was to help people and describe themselves as refugees from the corporatization of America. So for them, even though they're practicing the same pursuits that they did in midlife, they're doing it in a new way and in a way that includes much greater meaning.
What, one of the things I wondered, Joe Quinn, is whether or not at Boston College you're seeing people return there and, picking up new lives. Do you offer special courses for folks who are retired?
No, we don't. We don't take advantage of that market very much at all at Boston College. But I notice in dealing with our own faculty that, again, a wide variety of preferences. Some people do retire at traditional retirement ages and are happy to do it, but much more common is people working on through 65 through 70, and then even after, in some sense, retiring from their tenure-track position, faculty members often will stay on and teach a course per semester or a course per year in the department, and they love doing it. Stays involved with the students and with their colleagues, and it's a wonderful transition for people.
So to some extent, we're seeing in these retirement programs a sort of subsidization, if I can get that out, of both education and medicine. It's an interesting way that retirement funds are being plowed back into the social picture. 1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Marina, you're on the line from Chesapeake, Virginia. Welcome to The Connection.
Oh, hello. Let me turn off my radio. I just wanted to tell you a little bit about myself as it relates to the subject. I'm what I call a late bloomer. I graduated from college when I was 50 and taught school in the state of Virginia for 10 years and had a plant nursery after that for a couple of years. And when I was 62, I went into the Peace Corps at the suggestion of a young friend of mine. And I always wanted to see the world, and I hadn't been anywhere, and I didn't have any money to go anywhere. And so in the process, I actually stayed out of the country pretty much for 8 years and traveled actually around the world, but mainly in Asia. And I think the Peace Corps is a wonderful, wonderful option. There's no upper age limit. The last I heard, the oldest person was a woman, 84, who'd been in the Peace Corps for 17 years. I think that probably one of the most satisfying things that a couple could do would be to go in the Peace Corps together. If you're married, you have to go in together. And I just find that more and more people say that if you stay active and keep your mind going and an open outlook, that it gets better and better, and I find that's true.
I saw a study, Marina, the other day, that at least a report on a study that said if you keep your mind active, you can stave off some of the consequences of Alzheimer's and some of those things because your mind is like a muscle. Marina's 78 years old. Marina, you're quite an inspiration calling in here.
Well, it's been great fun. You know, when I look back, I think, gee, I've had a great life, and I'm not going anywhere in the town soon, I don't think. I mean, away from here, I'm still traveling, actually.
Mark Friedman, is the Peace Corps and AmeriCorps, things like that, are you seeing people go into those in retirement?
Absolutely. I think Marina's experience is going to become the new American retirement dream. It's going to replace the golf course retirement. This essentially, and especially I think with the 60s generation being the first of the boomers to hit later life, I think we're going to see a return to their earlier idealism, but one that's tempered by experience. And I think so many people who dreamed about going into the Peace Corps when they were in college, but life kind of got in the way, are going to return to pursuits like that. My only concern is that the Peace Corps is a very small program, and only a certain segment of the population is going to be willing to go abroad. I think we need to create a similar corps in the United States in size and scope to AmeriCorps, and that's the reason we've been working to develop the Experience Corps program in the U.S., which focuses on inner-city elementary schools and is essentially a Peace Corps for those folks who want to stay in their own community and to try to remedy social inequities there. And it's in a lot of ways a transitional vehicle for people, too. So many Experience Corps members have become public school teachers after being involved in the program. And I am concerned in general that we have more options for people like the Peace Corps, like Experience Corps, because there are going to be so many like Marina who are going to want this particular kind of retirement. And right now the options are limited. We did a national survey a year ago, showed there was a huge proportion of Americans 50 to 75 who wanted to focus on public interest work in later life, but they felt that they had no place to go. The picture that emerged essentially was all dressed up with no place to go.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. We're talking about retirement. Bob is calling from Norfolk, Virginia. We've got quite a Virginia input here. Bob,
yes,
welcome to the connection.
Hi, we miss Chris, but you're doing real well.
Oh, thanks.
I want you to know that. Anyway, I retired a year and a half ago from my health profession, and I have a wonderful wife and five granddaughters, so we do a fair amount of travel. But in my profession, I was active in the nonprofit sector, but now I've just totally immersed myself in the Christ Museum, the opera, the local university. In fact, I'm on my way now to the University Educational Foundation meeting, but also public radio and public TV, and my federation and foundation. So I have every day a couple appointments with a nonprofit to do something that I get a lot of satisfaction from.
Bob, you first of all, you don't sound like you're from Virginia. And
I'm originally from Boston. You picked that up.
It's not hard to pick up. So you don't have to work. You don't have to make money, right? You can do these nonprofit things because
I was prudent. The government passed legislation allowing doctors to incorporate in the 70s and set up a retirement plan, and so our group practice funded it, and I think I'm doing okay financially. But now, Winston Churchill said, making a living is what you get, but making a life is what you give. So for all those people who have done well on the first part, I invite them to explore the second.
Bob, thanks very much. Joe Quinn, you were...
These are really wonderful stories, and I just want to point out that the labor force participation rate statistics that I began with, which show this rebound from the troughs of the 1980s, of course, don't even include people like Bob in Virginia who are working voluntarily in the nonprofit sector, not drawing a paycheck. And, of course, there's no reason why those who can afford to do so would be restrained to the market economy. There's all these fabulous volunteer opportunities out there that make for a healthier and life for the person who's providing the services, but also for the people who are on the other end. So I'm really encouraged by these stories.
And I'll echo what Joe was saying. Even folks who are in the market economy, in those part-time jobs, which Joe Quinn describes as being the principal kind of work people will be doing in later life, part-time workers are the real heroes of civil society. They actually volunteer at higher rates than people working full-time or working not at all.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. We want to take another call here from Jan in Iowa County, Iowa. Iowa County? Hi, Jan.
Hi, I hope you can hear me. I know there's some static out here. Real quickly, since we spent so long learning how to, or trying to learn how to save for retirement, there is a desperate need for us, with our experience, to transfer that back to our 5-year-olds and on up, because there is a vast gap in financial education at all levels of schooling. And I work in the financial field. I'm an investment counselor. I do as much counseling as I do investing. And it's very sad to see a 60-year-old come to you 3 weeks before retirement and say, I never have understood anything about finance or anything about my retirement plan or lack thereof. And this 20-year party that, you know, we all these baby boomers were on, which I happen to be one of those, for instant gratification has caught us obviously by surprise. But I also see a tremendous gap in trying to educate our general population on, simple savings and then eventually investing and what this all means. And we have plenty of resources from the adult standpoint, but we really could get that experience core group of people out there to work with our schools.
Well, Jan, thanks very much for your call. We're going to go out to Mark Friedman just for a comment on your call. Very quickly, Mark, we're almost out of time.
Well, as much as we need to do financial education for later life, and we have multi-billion-dollar financial planning industry, we're doing virtually nothing to help people do life planning for this extra bonus of 30 years that we've got. And I think a lot of people are finding that they have to do all the heavy lifting themselves. So as a society, I think we need to combine financial planning with planning about how we're going to live vital, active lives in the third age.
Joe Quinn, do you think President Bush needs to do something about this to take advantage of all these people who are available for social services?
Well, I think it's a great idea. I would just like to comment briefly on Jan's last point about teaching people how to save and, as Mark says, how to plan for retirement, how to develop retirement skills. The point is a simple one. The earlier we start, the better. Saving a dollar when you're 55 doesn't turn into much when you're 62. Saving a dollar at 25 turns into a lot more.
Thanks, Joe Quinn. Joe is a professor and affiliate of the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College. And thanks to you, Mark Friedman, who's the author of Prime Time, How Baby Boomers Will Revolutionize Retirement and Transform America. And thanks to Dan Shore, NPR commentator who joined us earlier in the hour. Connection listeners, you can continue the retirement conversation on our website at theconnection.org. I'm John McChesney. This is The Connection. Thanks for listening. Through this life, so we can fly away. Saving it all up for you. Bungalow. Bungalow. You.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and by the Allaire Corporation.